So as some of you know, I've been teaching this intermediate class on mindfulness meditation. And the emphasis in this class, which is, you know, one of the emphasi, is that the right word? we can have in practice, there's a number of different ones, at different times, different things are appropriate. But the emphasis has been on the active side of mindfulness, that it's something we actively engage in, the active side, as opposed to the more receptive or the passive side of. And one of the active aspects of then a life based on mindfulness is the quality of discernment. And last week here I gave a talk on discernment or wisdom. And wisdom, using the word wisdom can lend itself to the idea that it's kind of somewhat passive. You have the wisdom and you just naturally exude it and make all the right choices in your life. Whereas discernment has the quality of, you know, you're really applying your intelligence to a situation and trying to discern what's going on, discerning what's the wisest course of action to take. Today I'd like to continue this discussion on discernment a little bit by talking about another aspect of discernment, or particular ways of being discerning. And as a background to this, I want to just emphasize the capacity we all have for being at peace, the capacity we all have of not being in conflict with ourselves or conflict with the world, and the capacity of really an astounding level of peace in our hearts and our minds, and in the way that we relate to the world around us. And it's not an experience that people have that much. There's degrees in which we feel at peace and feel at calm. And the Buddhist tradition points to a phenomenal capacity of peace and calm that is much more than just, you know, having gone for, you know, having a nice weekend and relaxed and not thought about work or something for a while. And so what is the path to that level of peace, that freedom of conflict? And the suggestion is that finding that path or being on that path, one of the factors that's needed is a factor of discernment, to be discerning, in the service of becoming peaceful. And I say that because some people hear the concept of discernment, of using your intelligence and being active, as being, oh no, now I have to be more busy and more agitated, more kind of filled with thoughts and ideas and confusion about what to do. And the idea is to be discerning about how we use our intelligence. So we use it in ways that are pointing or supportive of going in the direction of this possibility of peace, if that's our motivation. And so the very way in which we engage in these kinds of questions is approach. Hopefully we look at how we do it, and is it in a way that's supportive of being peaceful, at peace. The topic for today then is a word called sampajana. And sampajana is probably, you know, pretty foreign to most of you. However, it's an important word because it's used quite frequently together with the word sati. And sati is the Pali word for mindfulness, which is the practice we do. And in the primary discourse by the Buddha where he talks about this particular practice of mindfulness, he uses that terms almost as a compound, sati sampajana. And so, and we emphasize a lot, I emphasize a lot the mindfulness part of that phrase, but not so much the sampajana. And sampajana, it's a little bit hard to know what the Buddha meant. That's maybe one of the reasons why we don't talk about it much. And it's translated by different people in different ways. The most common translation is clear comprehension. Another translation is awareness, just very simply, awareness. Awareness being different than mindfulness. Someone else has translated it as alertness. Seems, you know, not such a technical word, just being alert, mindful and alert, mindful and aware, mindful and clearly comprehending what you're mindful of. And the word sampajana is used in another compound, sampajana musavada. Which musavada means, or musa means to lie. And here it kind of probably translates into English as deliberate lie, or lying with knowingly lying. So it's a kind of clear comprehension, clear knowing, being clear, yes, now I'm lying. So this kind of sense of being deliberate or being considered or being comprehending clearly what we're doing, it seems to be part of what sampajana means. It's not so, as I said, it's not so clear how the Buddha used it. After all, he lived 2,500 years ago, and we can't ask him. And he didn't define it that clearly in the suttas. But what we can do is turn to a later body of a commentary called the Abhidharma, which lists four different types of sampajana, clear comprehension. Now, when people who don't know don't know what I'm talking about, but in terms of Abhidharma, some people know just enough about Abhidharma to know, oh no, he's going to talk about the Abhidharma. because Abhidharma can seem to be very dry, a kind of analytical discussion about the psychology of meditation, of spiritual life, in great detail. And also some people kind of want to poo-poo the Abhidharma because it's appeared later, after the teachings of the Buddha, and if people feel somehow it's a little bit of a delusion, of a dilution of the teachings of the Buddha. And if you really want the truth, you go back to the Buddha himself. I find the Abhidharma sometimes very helpful. And this list of four clear comprehensions, I see in the spirit that the Abhidharma is often just is describing what's already here. It's a descriptive analysis of what's found in the mind or in as we experience life. And so what's fascinating is the four sampajanas are aspects of your mind, of how your mind works, that you already have and you already do this. And so in talking about them, the texts are pointing to something you already do. But sometimes in recognizing, oh, this is what I do, that you haven't noticed before. Oh, maybe I could augment this, nourish this, use this more fully for its potential of how it can help me towards the path of becoming peaceful or more open or loving. So as you listen to this, you might listen from that point of view, is how am I already doing this? Not, oh no, here's, you know, these Buddhists telling me how, what I should be doing. Does that make sense? Okay. So, the four aspects of clear comprehension. The first one, I'll go through the list first and then we'll talk about them. The first the list are clear comprehension of purpose. Clear comprehension of the domain of practice. Clear comprehension of suitability, what's suitable, and clear comprehension of non-delusion. To say it in kind of more ordinary language, it's to be clear about your purpose. It's to be clear about the particular context in which you can fulfill that purpose. To be clear about what's suitable to do that, how to do that, and to be clear about being clear. So to be clear about what's going on. And to be clear comprehension, being clear about your purpose. The importance of that probably can't be underscored enough. Is that the word underscored? Is that a musical term? The underscores, where does that come from?
The under. To draw a line under
something. Just means that. Sorry. It's important to get clear on these things. So clear comprehension, or to be clear about the purpose. And this applies to any aspect in life. You know, what's the purpose for which I'm doing this? Am I doing this in order to, you know, whatever the reason is? And sometimes we're not clear about the purpose why we do something. And sometimes, you know, we're operating somewhat unconsciously or subconsciously. Sometimes we might have some sense of purpose, but it's not really the deepest sense of purpose we can have. We've inherited the purposes that our society tells us we're supposed to have. But to spend some time contemplating and getting clear about what is the purpose I'm doing anything that I'm doing, to live a deliberate life, to live a life that's considered. In the Buddhist tradition, it's considered very important. I remember in the old days, some of the Vipassana teachers loved to quote Carlos Castaneda or Don Juan. And Don Juan saying that a warrior lives an impeccable life. And to live an impeccable life is to live a life that's very deliberate, very clear. And sometimes I'm a little bit oppressed by this idea of living a deliberate life. But mostly I feel oppressed by it when I feel a little bit harried by life to begin with. But if I feel somewhat calm and settled, then it's very clear, it's deeply satisfying to go and do things in a kind of deliberate way, considered way. That doesn't have to sacrifice our spontaneity or freedom, but to be kind of, when you're very calm, there's a kind of beauty in just kind of knowing what you're doing and being right there for it as you do it, to be kind of deliberate or considered, to be clear what you're doing when you're doing it. So have a sense of the purpose. In a spiritual life, having a sense of purpose is also very important, because if you know what your purpose is, then you can know best what the means is to fulfill that purpose. And a lot of people enter into spiritual circle, spiritual life, with a very general sense, oh, this is a good idea. Very general sense of, you know, this is inspiring, it's wonderful, it's wonderful teachings, wonderful people. You know, it kind of validates, you know, it's a place where you get validation for being a human being or for being close to the truth. Or there's all kinds of reasons why people come into spiritual practice that doesn't involve being really clear about the purpose, what their purpose is for being there. And if you can clearly know what your purpose is and discern and kind of separate out the various kinds of purposes, that some of them are, you might realize some of the purposes you're doing spiritual practice are not healthy, not good for you. And some of them are. Just the fact that you're involved in spiritual practice doesn't mean that it's good for you. A lot of it, whether it's good for you, has to do of what purpose are you doing it for. So, for example, if you're doing it to build up your ego, to be, you know, the best Buddhist on your block, you know, you could be very diligent and sincere in your practice, you know, for that purpose, but it's not really healthy for you to follow spiritual practice to be the best Buddhist on your block. The people on your block probably, you know, not good for them either. And, you know, if you're building up your sense of ego. So there are unhealthy ways, unhealthy purposes for being involved in a spiritual life. And there's also healthy ones. And it could be very simple. I think from the Buddhist point of view, one of the healthiest ones is to become healthy, to want health. And in other words, not to suffer. To simply become free of suffering is one of the more healthy motivations to be had. Anyway, but to be clear about the purpose we have, once you have a purpose, or know what your purpose is, to the best of your ability, then you can get clear about what the appropriate domain is for your spiritual practice. What's the appropriate context for following through on that purpose. I remember when I was in Burma with Upandita, my teacher. He was kind of a tough teacher. And when I was first there, I remember him giving some talks where he said, if you're doing some kind of compassion practice while you're here, stop that. And because people would come there from all over, you know, and do all kinds of practices. And he would say, don't, you know, stop that. And it was kind of harsh to hear, stop your compassion practice? I mean, that's such a beautiful thing, and it's such an ennobling and helpful thing for our planet, for people to cultivate compassion. He said, don't do that. And what I understood very quickly was that he didn't think that compassion practice was a bad idea. But he assumed that the purpose for you being there in his monastery was a purpose for you to become liberated. And if that was your purpose, it's really helpful while you are there to narrow what you do so you're kind of single-mindedly pursuing or engaged in that practice which serves that purpose. So it's outside the domain, outside the context for that particular liberative practice he taught to do compassion practice. I think he hoped that you'd do that once you left his monastery, once you were liberated. Or, you know, but when you're doing this one particular thing on that retreat, be clear on what your purpose is, and then appropriately limit what you do so you're not dispersing your energy in too many different directions and you're not getting really concentrated on the particular thing you want to do. If you're not concentrated on one particular thing, you might not be able to follow through as far as you can on that particular thing. So the word for domain, be clear about the domain in Pali is gochara. And gochara, go, apparently means cow, which kind of makes sense, right? This wonderful Indo-European way in which words, in Norwegian, the word for cow is ku. And so cow, ku, go in Pali. And chara means where they go. It means it kind of means a pasture where cows go to eat. And being clear about where you should go to eat. If you have a certain purpose, where do you get nourished? Where's the place of nourishment for that particular, to fulfill that purpose? And to think about that, to be clear about that, to be considerate about that, take that into account. And there was a wonderful I visited in Thailand. There's a monastery called Swan Mok, where Buddhadasa, was a famous monk, was the abbot. And he was very old when I was there and didn't have much contact with him. But I had a lot of contact with the assistant abbot, a beautiful man who's now the abbot since Buddhadasa is dead, and Ajahn Po. And one of the times I showed up at the monastery, I must have asked him some question. I forget what the question was. But he told me, if being in a monastery is helpful, nourishing for your practice, then stay, as long as it's nourishing. If it's not, then leave so fast you don't even say goodbye to the abbot. So that was a very dramatic way of saying it. I think that in a civil society, it's helpful that we talk to each other a little bit. And if we have some problem, it's nice at least to tell the people involved, I'm leaving now, but out of respect for you, let me tell you, why. But clear understanding of the domain, of what's supportive, what nourishes that purpose. The third clarity is the clarity being clear about what's suitable to fulfill that purpose. It's a little bit different than the second one, because there might be a lot of different things which are in the context, in the field, the general field of how to pursue something. But then there might be any given day, any given meditation session, any given minute, a different approach that's required. It is suitable. And some things are suitable at one time, sometimes something is suitable another time. Some things are suitable, sometimes we think of spiritual practice as involving developing different qualities, different aspects of our inner life, our psyche. And so we might need to kind of tactically develop different things at different times. So at certain times we might want to emphasize the cultivation of our virtue. Other times we want to cultivate and emphasize our cultivation of concentration. Other times we might want to cultivate our good relationships with the people around us. Other times we might want to cultivate our loving kindness. Other times we might want to cultivate reflection on death. All are Buddhist practices, and all can be supportive of an overarching purpose. But it's kind of like, I don't know what the right expression is, but I have a battle expression in my mind. Sometimes you fight, I don't know, but it doesn't make sense, I guess. But in order to win a war, you have to fight a lot of small battles. And if in order to, sometimes you have to kind of build on a lot, put a lot of different building stones in place in order to build a house. So a clear comprehension of suitability is to look at what is suitable at any given time and place. And there's a lot of different factors that come into play. If a mindfulness meditation center has plopped down the middle of your community, if you live in right in Redwood City or a couple blocks away, maybe it's very suitable to check that out because it's so convenient. But say that, a Zen center showed up, or say, some other thing showed up, a yoga center. It's so easy, it's so supportive, so suitable then to do that particular activity. as you know, strategically, because it's so easy and you can develop that part of yourself. What is suitable for cultivating mindfulness? Sometimes you need to have more inspiration, and so perhaps reading a Dharma book or going to a talk. Sometimes you need to get more, a little bit more sober, and, or look at your values more. And sometimes reflection on death is helpful. Sometimes maybe loving kindness is helpful if you're not so kind to yourself as you're practicing. Sometimes we maybe a sense of acceptance or generosity is what's needed. There's a lot of different things which are suitable depending on what is an antidote to, what it's a balance to. Clear comprehension of suitability. Say that, I love getting up in the morning to meditate. And pretty committed to doing that, the best I can. But now with this newborn baby at home, it's put a little speed bump on that. And I could, take my stand and get up in the morning and say to my family, it's really important. I'm going to sit every, it's really important. I sit. This is my spiritual practice, and this is what I do. And, as I sit down, and the baby's crying, and the other kid is yelling, and the wife is pulling her hair out, that's not a very suitable time to sit and practice mindfulness and meditation. to be clear about what is suitable in any given time and place. Or say, say you're sitting in meditation and you're feeling tired. Maybe sitting meditation is not appropriate, not suitable at that particular time. You do have time to meditate. Maybe what you should do is do walking meditation. That's what's suitable. Get up and do walking meditation during that sacred time of sitting, meditation. There's many different ways of doing mindfulness practice. To have a sense of the different ways of doing it is helpful. To be clear about where the mindfulness is going to be directed. What's suitable? Go back to the second category. What's the domain? What's the particular thing that nourishes it? What's the context? One of the principles of vipassana is that vipassana, mindfulness meditation, always takes as its as an object of awareness something which is real or something actual, something that's actually happening in the present moment. As opposed to letting our very precious awareness flow into our fantasies or planning the future or our projections onto the past or all kinds of things. That's not actually what's happening right now. So clear suitability of purpose, clear suitability of domain, clear suitability clear comprehension of suitability has a lot to do with knowing in mindfulness practice that what's suitable for mindfulness practice is actually what's happening now, not your imagination or concepts of what's happening. And for me, that was very important to realize that. Because I had, before doing mindfulness practice, spent a lot of time in meditation in a kind of ethereal kind of fantasy world, thinking about my meditation, thinking about how nice things were, or thinking about the future, thinking about how good my meditation was going to be tomorrow, if I just kept doing this, planning it out, or just planning about something else. And to actually clearly see that the domain and the direction of practice unfolds by learning how to connect to what is actually happening in this moment. What is happening right now is the key to the unfolding of mindfulness practice and is the key to finding out how to be deeply at peace. The kind of deep peace of a Buddha is found only through connecting to what's actually happening right now. Not connecting to an ideal, not connecting to anything which is imaginary, but what is actually happening right now. So the primary vipassana question is, what is happening now? What is happening now? You ask what is happening now, and you see what's happening now, you're aware of it, and then you start analyzing and thinking about it and judging it and planning around it, then you've missed the next actual. And so it's a continual movement, moment by moment, of waking up to what is actually happening now and not lingering with what happened 2 minutes ago. It's like taking a snapshot, taking a Polaroid picture or something of something, and then going around holding that picture, say, this is what it is. Not realizing whatever you took a picture of has been is changing after you take the picture. So the continuity of what's happening now, what's happening now. And the third thing to become clear about, is to become clear about clarity. To become clear, the word is non-delusion. And this has a lot to do with really being clear about what's actual. To learn to distinguish between what's imaginary, what's concepts, what's ideals, what's projections, what's interpretations, from what's actually happening. And so there's a constant discernment going on, constant questioning of our assumptions. Is this really what's happening here? Is my understanding really the real thing happening? And the mind is so slippery, so quick to slip in those interpretations and then to believe the interpretations are really what's happening. And so we have to get very clever, discerning about how the mind describes any event to see if we can distinguish between the interpretation of the event and actually what's happening. I'll use myself. Hope maybe it's paints myself in a bad light to give this example, but for the purposes of teaching. I had some time ago a little fantasy for only a few minutes, but a fantasy of, I don't know exactly how it arose, but someone write my biography. I don't have that interesting life, but someone had to write my biography. But the reason why I stayed with that thought for a little while was, I thought, that'd be fascinating if the person didn't interview me, but interviewed all the people that knew me over my lifetime, and then wrote my biography based on their view of me. And then I got to read it. And I got to write my rebuttal. And I thought it would be a fascinating kind of study about the difference between how people are seen and how they see themselves. And whenever, if some author is writing a biography of someone who's dead, and they go and interview all the people who knew the person, then, does it really describe the life of that person? Well, if we could have if we could have that exercise of someone writing biography, never talking to the subject, and the subject afterwards reading it and, responding, that you would really see the difference. And that would, be very humbling for all future biographers. Anyway, I'm sorry. Anyway. clear comprehension of non-delusion, of seeing clear, of seeing the interpretation, seeing the delusions we have. And in my mind, clear comprehension of non-delusion has a lot to do with being able to pick up and see when we are deluded. To be able to see, I'm interpreting. I don't know if that's really the case. To be clear about that. I use this a lot. And I try to use that in my conversations. I say, I don't know why you said what you said, or I don't know what happened there. But this is how I interpreted it. And I realize that I'm holding this very lightly because I don't know. But maybe if I tell you my interpretation, you can either tell me it's not so, or maybe maybe you can clarify what happened better. But I can be clear about when it's an interpretation, when it's delusive. So it's kind of like the culmination of practice is to be clear about non-delusion, to really know that you're clear, to be clear about being clear. So, do you do all those things? Are you sometimes clear about your purpose? Do you have a purpose? Do you sometimes kind of discern what the appropriate realm is for fulfilling that purpose? Decide you want to go be mindful, and you don't go to the Great American Parkway. You could, but probably go somewhere else. Are you clear about what's suitable at any given time and place for fulfilling that purpose? And are you clear about when you're clear? Are you clear about when you're fulfilling that purpose? So that was my attempt to try to point from a different angle at the importance of being discerning. And I think discerning is something we all do all the time. Can we use our natural abilities to be discerning to help us become more peaceful, become kinder, more compassionate? Can we help our natural capacity to be discerning to help us be less in conflict with the world that we live in? And the teachings of the Buddha, I believe, says you can do that, and you're encouraged to do that. So that's my pep talk for today. And now we have some time for some questions or comments about this or anything else. Yes, please.
I have a thought and a question. The thought is that it seems like those four elements of discernment apply not only to religious practice, but to any kind of activity
yes.
that we might do.
Yes.
The question is that for me, the fourth of them is the one where I have the most trouble. I can often fool myself into thinking that I have clarity and later discover that I didn't. And so if you could reflect more on how you tell, that would be helpful.
The question is how come he said that he's least clear or least competent in the last one, because sometimes he can fool himself. And how to work with that? I think you should give yourself a lot of credit about learning from experience, and good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. is a saying. So it's partly through trial and error. And I understand Buddhist practice to unfold through trial and error. And you make little mistakes and you learn from your mistakes. You learn from, you know, what goes on. So, and part of that principle is that you have to, part of your practice is to learn from the mistakes. Oh, I was fooled there. How can I learn from that? How can I think about that, reflect on it? How can I, you know, not just simply brush it away, but what can I learn from this experience so that I won't be fooled in the future? Another way is to is the practice of mindfulness, to strengthen the mindfulness when you're doing things. So you're mindful, you're discerning of such things as the purpose you're doing things, the intention. What's the motivation? Why you're doing something? Sometimes the motivation is a key. Sometimes it's when the motivation is off is when we're most likely to fool ourselves. Sometimes it has to do with other qualities. I've noticed in myself, I'm more likely to be fooled myself if I don't live a deliberate life. If I'm rushing around, being busy, if I'm afraid, then I tend more likely to be fooled. So I tend to stop for those kinds of things. I try to. If I feel like I'm rushing, I try to stop and not rush and pay attention to what's going on. If I feel afraid, I'll often stop for that. And very honestly tell myself, oh, I'm afraid now. And sometimes that clarity about being afraid will help protect me from the fear then triggering some kind of understandings or motivations or projections where I get fooled. How do we not get fooled? Is the question. Do other people have some experiences of how they don't get fooled? Oh no. Yes?
Well, it may be kind of stating the obvious, but one of the ways you can learn from experience is to kind of see your own patterns and kind of say, oh, okay, this is a familiar scenario in which I have tended to get fooled in the past, and kind of, you know, kind of learn when to have your antenna up, especially well. Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes it's helpful to include other people in your foolishness, which means which means if you think it's a place where you might be fooled or you're unsure, is to tell people, I'm unsure right now what's going on. I have this understanding. What do you think of that understanding? And I can include other people as part of that processing, that discernment. I find it very helpful to let people, other people in what's going on. And they can mirror back to you. Oh, yeah, you're a little bit off. But we're so afraid as people, right? Oh, better not let anybody know that I don't understand or that I'm deluded or that, you know. Yes?
Sounds like whenever you say that on this last discernment is that there's an absolute clarity. And it seems like to me in my life that the clarity that I have at one moment or something may be different than the clarity I have at another. Is this sort of a delusion on my part all the time? Or is it just that in certain circumstances, the clarity of the way I see myself and what I do and my judgment and things is really different 10 years later or 5 seconds later?
Even though I held forth now for a while on these four different clear comprehensions, I don't know the true way of interpreting these four categories. Could be all this whole talk could have been foolish. And what I did was I took these four categories and I've studied them in the past a little bit. I know a little bit about what's meant in the Buddhist tradition, and I try to find how they're useful and try to kind of discuss them and interpret them in ways that hopefully was useful for all of you. What it means to be clear about non-delusion. I think if you find your experience in different situations, you can be clear, and later you have a different clarity because of greater experience or whatever. I mean, I would, that's actually your experience, and I would just be content with that and learn from that. I suspect that in the Abhidharma, when they have this last clarity about non-delusion, they're talking about someone who's enlightened. And to be really enlightened person is supposed to, in the early tradition, be very, very clearly aware that their mind is no longer operating on delusion. It doesn't mean you understand everything. It doesn't mean you're not going to misunderstand something. But it means that the mind is not going to actively operate out of greed, out of hate, or out of a kind of misunderstanding of that aspect of the experience. How do I say this? Clear about greed, hate, and delusion. But what is delusion here means no longer imposing on the experience. You realize you no longer have a tendency of imposing on the experience something which is not inherent in the experience. So the claim is that when you're enlightened, you really clearly see that the mind is no longer doing any one of those three things. And you probably had that experience. Certain moments in your life, you're probably really clear. Or right now, there's no greed operating, there's no hate operating, and I'm not imposing anything on top of my experience. It is what it is. So clear comprehension of non-delusion, I think, in the tradition, means someone who's fully enlightened. But that's not very useful for those of us who are not fully enlightened. So we try to use these categories in ways that are helpful to help us be more discerning. Is that okay as an answer? Yes?
So I'm not sure if this is anything to do with Buddhism or not, but sometimes when I'm not clear, which I feel at the moment, I feel very unclear, it seems like the only thing that really helps is to just let the emotion hit me. And then when it's gone, I can see more clearly. I'm more tired, but I can see more clearly.
So when you're not clear, you find the most useful thing is to be with your emotions.
Yes.
Okay. So let's back up and say, so you notice something is going on. You realize you're confused or unclear. So given that that's what you notice, what is your overall, what's your purpose?
I want my clarity back.
Okay.
I want my clarity back and my peace back.
And what is the appropriate domain for finding that? Reading a book or going to the movies or where's the domain? Where do you have to, what part of your life do you have to enter into in order to get your clarity and peace back?
Well, I have certain places where I go where people encourage me to be with my feelings.
Great.
You know, and when that happens frequently, there's a lot of tears. And then when that's gone, I guess I don't feel anxious, which is mainly what's happening, is I've got some anxiety that's trying to bite me on the butt, is the way I think about it. And if I just stop and let it come, you know, just let it come, I guess maybe be around people who will kind of hold me, you know, sort of emotionally, you know, feel safe, just let it come. And then when I leave, then I can see more clearly again. Because, like, right now, I know I can't discern anything. I'm off.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm just off.
Great. So what I'm trying to do is going through the four categories with you. So, because you're doing it, I think. So you realize a problem. The problem is you're not so clear, you're confused, anxious. You have a purpose, which has become clear and peaceful. And you realize that the domain for doing that is to be around people who help support you to be with your feelings. And then how you be with your feelings is, what's a suitable way of being with your feelings? You probably have some sense. What's a suitable way of being with your feelings once you're there with them?
I guess honoring them, realizing they're temporary, just letting them come. Not trying to hold them off, not trying to reason them away, just letting them come.
Great. So we have the first three already. And what about the fourth one? How does non-delusion, being clear about non-delusion, come into play?
Well, I mean, I guess I can recognize that when I am deluded, like right now, I recognize my perspective is off. Not a good time to make any important decisions.
Great.
And so then when I've gone through this, then I can more, I guess when I can discern something clearly, there's something in me that resonates. Yes, this is true. No, that's not true. Right now, I know I can't feel it. That muscle isn't working. You know, and so when I've gone through this, eventually that comes back.
Great. Well, thank you. I mean, I feel your suffering as you're talking about this. I hear a lot of wisdom too about how to relate to it. You're not on the other side yet, but these four, you know, discernments are operating to some degree with you, and it seems like you have the wisdom to know how to, you know, do what you're doing. So that's really great, and I wish you well with that.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm sort of thinking about a little bit of the reverse. In regard to relationships, it seems to me in some of my relationships, I am really sure in my mind the other person's intention, feeling, or they're really sure of mine and they tell me that. I'm sure that you behave this way out of X motivation, and I'll say, I'm sure that's not what was in my mind, but they're quite clear about that. On the one hand, I know that you can never truly know what another person's mind. On the other hand, it seems like we must have the ability somehow. How can you be clear about what's happening in the moment if the other people around you are totally inscrutable? And I wondered if you could say anything about clarity and understanding other people's motivations.
Oh, clarity about other people's motivations. Why are you asking that question?
I guess it's something I've been struggling with, and it seems like the problem is not sometimes for me delusion. Sometimes the problem is being so clear in your mind that about something that you can't allow for there being something else. And then that's actually more difficult.
Well, I think if you know that's happening, that you're so clear, so set in your ways or set in your views, if that knowledge is there, I think that's the beginning of opening it up. You can actually do it very actively. You can say to your mind, okay, let me think about some other options. What are the other perspectives to understand this? And asking, you know, just going through the exercise, is there another angle to understand this experience? You know, if you realize there's a problem, there's always a way. That's like 90% of the work. And then you have to kind of, find your way. if you're asking about knowing other people's motivation, there can be some sense of what other people are about and their motivation. In thinking about this talk today, one of the things I was not going to talk about was when I was deluded in Calcutta, and someone swindled me out of my traveler's checks. And so I learned from that experience about who to trust and who not to trust. And I didn't have the discernment to see this person's motivation, but I should have. And so there are things we could know, and we have to kind of be wise a little bit to what we do. But I find it's useful when I'm talking to someone else or engaging with someone else, if it's appropriate, is to ask them. You say, what's your motivation? Or to talk in I statements, saying, when you do that, I feel this way. As opposed to saying, saying something about them. When you do that, I feel this way. What's going on with you? And try to help other people, help get other people to say what's going on, and then ask questions, rather than imposing my view on someone. Or if I have some view of someone, I might say, I have this view about you. Is it okay if I tell you, so that maybe I can get some other perspective? If someone's imposing a view on me, then I might say, the way you described early on, I might start off by saying, when you say that to me, when you say this is what your motivation is, I feel boxed in, and I feel like I can't really have a conversation with you. It's very painful for me to be in that kind of situation. Is there some way that we can have that conversation so I don't have to feel in so much pain? Can we allow for some open possibility? So one of the principles that I try to live by is to practice mindfulness out loud. And mindfulness is not talking about interpretation, but talking about what actually is going on. And I trust that in most situations that's suitable. And that's one of the ways to kind of break any kind of frozen view or kind of when things are locked in, views and opinions and stuff. And we start talking about what's actually happening in the moment. Not actually what happened yesterday, but because that almost immediately is an interpretation. What's actually happening at this very moment, that often loosens up the whole conversation and the view of everything that's going on. So, I hope that was helpful. So, I hope this talk was helpful. I hope it didn't muddle all of you and all these categories and stuff, but I hope that you can be calmly deliberate in all that you do so that you can be more at peace and more loving and more non-judgmental about who you are. And may all of you bring your discernment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you.